lights out, we're underway. Motorsport Republica podcast.
G'day guys, welcome back to another episode of the Motorsport Republica podcast with Scott Redding. Mate, how are ya?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Mate, good. Now, you're stuck with me, unfortunately. Tom can't make it, Daniel can't make it, so it's just you and me. But it is awesome, and thank you for giving your time to hear. It's really, really nice.
Yeah, well, I'm at the island anyway, so, you know, we got a day off, so why not come and do a podcast?
Mate, it's good, and we've obviously been messaging each other a couple times over the year. It's been cool. You've kept up to date with a couple of our things, a few of our small controversies, but it's really cool to see.
Yeah, it's good. Some of your stuff does make me laugh. That's something that I kind of keep inside. Like, I think that's kind of cool, and that's why I mess you. Like, you know, if you want to do something, let's do it.
Mate, it's super, super cool, and it's man, I've been watching you for as long as I can remember at the same time. Like, I think, when were you born? 93, 94?
93, yeah.
I was 94, and I remember you watching you when I was like 15, 16. And I remember thinking, God, this guy's my age traveling the world, and I'm in like, I'm 15 in my bedroom eating Doritos watching him. But it's just what an amazing journey. It's crazy.
It has been a crazy journey, but also amazing at the same time. And even like you said, you were 15, probably eating Doritos in your bedroom. And I look at 15-year-old kids now and I think, how on earth was I doing what I was doing?
For sure.
But mentally, inside my head, I didn't feel like that. I never looked at myself like, oh, I was too young to be doing that. I was traveling to Spain with a teammate when I was 14, so I was not old enough to travel. And my wife has younger siblings, and they are like that age now. And I'm like, they can't even leave the house to go and do something, let alone travel. Like, it's kind of scary when I look back at it now.
Man, definitely. And like, we've had this conversation so many times, but it seems like you look at either the English or the Americans or the Aussies or the Japanese, like, there's especially the Aussies and the Americans, like, there's such a far way you have to travel to even just get there. But then even like going all the way through Europe, like yourself, and doing all that at 15, you don't even know what life is at 15, and then you're racing and have all this pressure on you.
Yeah, and I didn't have any guidance. That was I was doing an interview earlier today, and we're speaking about me and Marquez, because we grew up racing each other. And I spent a lot of time beating him in the lower rankings on 125 Spanish Championship, first year in GP. But then he had a lot of money backing from Red Bull and Repsol.
Yeah.
And I basically had nothing. Mm. And he went into like a factory KTM team, which was built for him. Then the year after, he was like factory KTM. And that followed him his whole way through his career. And I was kind of had a management that wasn't really knowing the sport of what we should be doing, what I should be saying, how I should be dressing. And I was the wild child. Mm. I was not the guy that was obeying rules. For me, rules were to be broken. That's how I looked at it. That's why I have the personality I have. But you see how it changed our career. And I believe if I had it a bit different, also my career would have turned out different, but I wouldn't change it for a second, because it's made me who I am today.
100%. And it's all life lessons. And you can't expect any 15, 16, 17, like even a 20-year-old to know what they're doing. Or like, you can have all the guidance as well, but it's still such high stakes and high pressure. And probably there's still a lot of unnecessary pressure put on these kids that go racing, because, like, you know, we've spoken to a few of the Aussie Moto3 riders, and it's interesting seeing their different personalities, but like how they handle it is still incredible. It's just a lot for a 15, 16-year-old.
It is, but you kind of born into it, and at least for me, you adapt to it on the moment, and that pressure never goes away. Mm. This year, I have the most pressure on my shoulders that I've probably ever had, you know, and it's like, I'm now on the second half of my career, should I say, but I still have that pressure, which doesn't feel any different. Like, and I always say the pressure is different as to what you're able to do. So when you have pressure to, say, win a world championship, and you have a bike that can win a world championship, I thrive off of that. Like, that makes me feel good. That makes me want to race, and that makes me train, and makes me get up every day. When you're expected to win or fight for a world title and you have a bike that can't do it, that's when you have a pressure that's hard to deal with, because what do? You're trying to perform because you have sponsors, teams, everyone's pressuring. They need results. No results, we don't get the sponsorship. But you have a bike that pretty much physically can't get there. What are you supposed to do? Then you start questioning yourself, and it's a downhill spiral you don't want to get into.
Man, definitely. I guess you've probably seen a lot of riders over your journey, you know, be in that situation, and it's probably so hard to also get out of, because, you know, like, it, you see a lot of the greats in any sport, but like, they're the ones that they can handle that pressure, or they can dig their way out of that hole. However they do it, they do it. And, you know, you see a lot of greats, they're ruthless. You know, they won't give an inch, whether that be in the media, whether that be on the racetrack, whether that be on the basketball court. It's just such a different mindset.
That's where, unfortunately, the motorcycle racing industry has changed over the years. 20 years ago, when you look back to the great battles, you know, the end of it was really your Valentino Rossi, Marc Márquez. But you look, Rossi versus Lorenzo, Rossi versus Seti Gibinau. That was personal. That was fucking racing, bro. Yeah. Like, that is, I love that. And that, for me, that was what I had. I used to be in the paddock. I had not even a handful of friends. If I had a friend that I in the same race, it was difficult. Like, I could manage it, but I didn't even see eye to eye with most of them. And nowadays, they're all sitting with each other, holding hands, you know, taking dinner together.
100%.
Like, I can't get that in my head. Like, for me, it's going to war. That's how I look. When I'm on that grid, that is going to war. And I used to struggle to come out of that when I took the helmet off. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, I hate you as much as you hate me, because I want to beat you as much as you want to beat me. And over the years, it's becoming more of like a friendly friendship thing. Like, they all train together. Fuck, I don't want to train with my rivals. Like, why would I want to do that?
Yeah.
Because they're all riding together. They're learning each other's strengths and weaknesses. It's never like you get to focus on yourself because you're too worried about everyone else. Like, maybe some people it works, but for me, it was never like that. And it's hard now because it's kind of the way the sport is going. You're expected to be nice. Like, if you give a middle finger to someone in the race, you get a fine.
Yeah.
If you say something bad, you get a fine. Like, motorcycle racing had that. Your Barry Sheen days where you had a fag out, you know, like, that was what motorcycle racing was. Formula One's always been that kind of higher end classy thing. Like, I'm okay with that. But motorcycle racing was like the nitty gritty.
Dirtier.
Yeah. And like, I loved that. And unfortunately, it's going away from it. But
I couldn't agree more. And I know the boys would 100% agree with you. Like, you look at, you're right, Valentino Rossi, he made it personal. And people loved him for it.
No, but you think about it, like,
guys, just want to say a massive shout out to our amazing sponsor, motoheaven.com.au. Now, Tom, I've actually had the privilege of going down to their store and seeing what they do. And the amount of packages that they send out and the amount of orders they have, is they've got a streamlined process. It's awesome. We want to give them a massive shout out because they do same day dispatch or next day dispatch. They do all the biggest brands, Shoei, HJC, Alpine Stars, Dine Easy. They've got an amazing website, amazing parts finder. You can get all the parts for your bike as well. So get down to motoheaven.com.au and you can get all your needs for your motorcycles, and that's for Australia and New Zealand.
People love that two rivals hate each other. When I watch it also, when I know it's personal and they're battling, you know they're going to do more than they would do for someone that they liked. Like, and you feel that. And that's what makes, like, hairs standing up, because that's what you're doing. You're battling. Yeah. You are literally going to war on a racetrack, on a motorcycle.
And it's so dangerous at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, we are battling with inches, and sometimes you're touching at, you know, over 200 miles an hour, which is madness. But in the moment, you aren't thinking about that. You're only thinking about beating that guy in front of you, and nothing else matters.
Yeah, that's right. And like, okay, you know, you can, like, you look at Crivier and Doohan back in the day. He basically punts Crivier off in the last corner and Jerez. Rossi does the same thing. You know, you had all the Marquez Rossi drama, but you just you think about that, like you just think, how good is this? And then you think about the winner who comes out on top as well, and like they're the most ruthless. Like you look at Marc Marquez. We say he's probably got more fans now, but man, was he hated for a long time.
For no reason.
For no reason.
No, that upset me. Like, for no reason. There was no need for that. But Rossi was very good at controlling the fans.
Yeah.
He's always been good at that. Yeah. That's why he is such a big name in the sport, because he was the only one that had, like, a personality.
Yeah.
Good or bad, he had a personality, and he played that very well. But when things got a bit rough and ready between him and Mark, and he played the fans against him, there was a bit naughty. Like, Mark was having people turn up at his house, you know, there was like death threats coming. Wow. There. Like, there's no need for that. And he could have stopped it. Mm. And that showed the, in my opinion, people aren't going to agree with it, showed the bad side of Rossi. When also Mark was getting booed last year in Misano, and Pecco Bagnaia was on the podium like, hey, like, you don't need to do that. Like, I have respect for him doing that. You don't need to, because in the end, they're risking their life. There's no need to be like that.
For sure. For, you know, realistically, for your entertainment, they're risking your life. Like, that's what it really comes down to.
Yeah.
And I never understood it. Like, I really don't. And I've actually, and everyone will know this, I've been a massive fan of Marc Marquez when I was a kid, and I've always loved aggressive sportsmen, whatever it is. Like, if someone doesn't care, or, you know, just try and throw it off the inside, whatever it is, driving, motorcycle racing, I think it's awesome. And when him and Rossi came together, like, just leave it on the track. It doesn't, Gavin Emmett, we spoke to him and I did a podcast with him. He's like, it doesn't have to be so tribal. Just leave it out in the track and then move on. Like, that's all. That's all.
But it's kind of hard. There's a lot weighing on it. It gets personal.
Yeah.
But what you were saying about the people that are more aggressive, there was a tennis player. I watched some, I'm not into tennis, but I watched some, it was like a Drive to Survive, but for tennis.
Oh, yeah.
And there was one tennis player that didn't really kind of play by the rules.
Kyrgios?
Oh, it could have been.
The Aussie?
It was Aussie.
Nick Kyrgios. Yeah.
And it was like, that entertained me because you just didn't know what he was going to do. It's like Max Verstappen in Formula One. People hate him, but they love him because they don't know what he's going to do. Like, and that's what sport is. It's an entertainment part. And then when you get two people like that that go head to head, like, that's good to watch.
And that's when, like, that sport will normally peak as well. Like, it's nowhere near as good as you said, when there's two riders or whatever that are the best mates going at it, because you know, like, they could be giving each other a whole lot more in that racetrack or in that battle, but that's just like, and it takes long for a rivalry to you know, hit that boiling point. Like, Mark and Valentino were good mates for a little bit, and then Valentino bit Mark, and then Mark bit him 10 times harder.
But do you know where it all started?
Wasn't that from Phillip Island or something, when he said he held him up or something like that?
Nah, it all started when Rossi has the dirt track place, the ranch, and Valentino invited Mark there. And it's like a fun thing, bearing in mind, from what I've never been, but from what I hear, Rossi has different bikes, different manufacturers for different conditions because it works different. It wouldn't surprise me because all these guys go 10 out of 10 to get the best. So Mark turns up there with the HRC truck and a full crew, and is, you know, and it was like full factory spec, and it really upset Valentino because it, like, disrespected the whole reason of going there. Like, Mark was just going to beat him, and I think he was very close, or he did beat him, just not in the main race.
Right.
And that was the start of the tic-tac, tic-tac. And then when it went onto the track, like you said, when he was like saying, I held him up, and then, you know, it just kept boiling more and more. But Mark's not gonna give an inch. He is that guy. Like, when people say, like, which riders do you think are, like, would go through a wall, like, end of the start and finish line, there's a brick wall, and how many riders would go through it? And I'd probably say one or two, and one of them would be Mark Marquez. Honestly, he wouldn't even think about it. He would just commit to the course.
That's insane. It's, and I 100% agree with you in that, but the HRC truck thing's kind of funny.
Full Arctic Lorry came out, seven guys, computers, all data logging. We did the Super Prestigio in Spain some years ago. They did that. And so I was living in Spain. I was, oh, yeah, I'll go do it. Bit of dirt track, you know, a bit of fun. So I turned up to this training day thing. And I'm like looking around. And it's like full factory. And I got the rule books, which basically said, you lower the front forks, you take the front mud guard off. I think it was 16 or 17 inch wheels. On the rear shock, you have to drill a hole to lower the rear. Like very basic. Yeah. Front brake off, basic. I turned up and they've got Olin suspension, front and rear, traction control, date. And I'm going like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Then you turn up to the race in Barcelona and they bring the dirt track guys over from the US. It was Brad Baker and someone else. Good riders, like that's their forte. But they come over, they bring a suspension and an exhaust pipe and they're riding a stock bike. Mark had an engine that was from Honda Supercross USA, like a 20, 30 grand engine with traction control. And I'm thinking like, you take the fun out of it. And that's why more and more people decided not to do it, because it's just unfair.
Yeah,
I'm not going to put 50 grand in to go in a circle for 8 seconds.
That's right.
But
that's crazy.
They'll do it to win.
But the thing is as well, is like to the naked eye, it doesn't look like those bikes have had that work done either. It just looks like an engine and some mud guards.
Honestly, there was different parts out of the frame for different stiffness. Like it was crazy. And I crashed in one of the sessions. I broke my sternum. And I did 2 heat races. I just took some painkillers. I was like, it's all right. Like, it'll be fine. And then someone hit me and I felt like it opened. And I was like, that did not feel good. So anyway, I watched the main race. And I was watching Mark. And I was like, he's got TC on that bike. Like, there is traction control. And he is playing with those. 2 laps to go. He was gone. And I was like, it was a show. But it makes the other guys like Brad Baker and the other American guy, I can't remember the name, it makes them look bad.
Yeah.
But they're just on stock bikes.
Yeah.
So.
And it's completely different. Do you watch much of the like American Supercross and Motocross? Are you into any of that scene?
I am into it. I just don't have a lot of time to study. I'm a highlight type of guy.
Yeah.
Just to keep an eye on what's going on. And that is just elevating to next level. Every year it just surprises me more and more what they're able to do.
They're nuts. And like it's been a wild year this year because there's been so many injuries. I feel like that's all we've been like on this podcast, that's all we've been talking about is injuries in every motorsport at the moment. But like everyone's dropping like flies and it was supposed to be the best year ever. Like the 2 Lawrence boys, obviously Tomac, Chase Sexton, but it's just like
it's becoming too extreme.
Yeah, it's to a degree.
You know, like 10 years ago, it had been double-double. Now it's just quad.
Yeah.
You know, and if you don't do it, you end there. So in their situation, they're being forced into having to do something they probably wouldn't really want to do. I watched the 2 rounds ago, and there was a huge jump on the straight. I can't, it was like from a double, and then I think it was meant to be a single, and then a roller into the corner. And in one of the races, one of the guys just doubled it, and I just... You know, and then you watch it, and for the next race, they know they have to double it. Yeah. Whether they want to do it or not, they got to do it.
Yeah.
And that's when things start to go wrong, because they're on a knife edge all the time.
On a knife edge, and you make one mistake. You make one mistake, and that's a wrap. And they're not really wearing that much armor. It's not like they have an airbag suit. It's
nothing. I ride motocross in the summer in a Lakers jersey, because the motocross kit ain't doing anything anyway.
There's no difference.
No, I wear a roost guard, I wear knee braces, and that's it. So, and I do think sometimes like, I'm licking like 4th gear, hitting jumps, and I think this could go bad. But it's just a motorcycle rider. You don't even think about it. I worry about that when I get to it.
Yeah, it's so true. It's definitely a different mentality. And like, you know, you look at so many off-season stuff over the years, motocross injury, collarbone, like to a Grand Prix rider or a superbike rider. It's just like, fuck, why? Why? Yeah. But it must be beneficial for your training.
Yeah. I used to do a lot of motocross. I've calmed it down a little bit over the years, but I was always like, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen.
Mm.
I'm not having that in my contract. That's one of my main things of training. Like, it keeps you super sharp. Like, the line's changing all the time. You go out, you do like 3 20-minute motos, and you are on the lap time trying to be consistent. Like, we're not out there just riding. We may not be super fast compared to a fast motocross rider, but for us, we are fast. Like when you push on a motocross bike, you feel fast, but then someone will come riding around the outside of you on their in lap. Yeah. You know, a pro guy who make you look silly, but you're on your limit. So it doesn't matter because I'm still giving 100% and I'm still trying to be consistent on lap times. Don't make mistake. And the track's changing constantly. You're overtaking people. Like, we don't ride our bikes away from the racetrack, especially like 10 years ago. No one had track training bikes. It was like supermoto motocross bike. Yeah. That was it. Now everyone's got like 600s or track bikes and you get out to track days now because they're a lot better. But before that was the main thing.
Like, you know, now there's all those little Ovales, they're taking over.
Yeah.
Do you do much of that?
I did until I broke my femur.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so it was a bit, 2019 before I did the BSB championship. Yeah. I was in the off season and I signed the contract. I come out of like a very dark place at Aprilia. And I was like, all right, let's go. Like, go to Spain training. I just recovered from broken ligaments in my ankle in Italy. So once I could drive, I drove to Spain to start training. I did one run, one cycle, one day on like the training superbike on a kart track. And then in that afternoon, I was like, I'll ride the Ovale on the kart track. Mm. So I was ragging around with Jake Dixon at the time.
Yeah.
And we were pushing on, nothing crazy. And was fourth gear, full gas on a 190 Ovale. I tipped into a corner, grabbed the brake and the throttle stuck open.
Oh.
So I lost the front. And as I was sliding, there was a gap in the tire wall like this. And I thought, oh, like, thank you. As I'm doing that, I see there's a concrete block like that. It was like a meter by a meter. It was a drainage thing, but it was raised out of the ground, concrete. And it had the steel plate on the top was turned. You know, like when you go to...
Yeah.
And it was like a knife. So I hit that, blew my my leg out. The metal cut open my arm. And I was led there going, fuck, like, this is not good. Like, I don't feel good at all. And my mechanic and Jake come over and they, like, the look on their face, I was like, this is a bad way. And I was bleeding out my arm, I was bleeding out of my femur. So I couldn't feel my leg. Mm. So I was like, I'm good. Like, it's all right, it'll be all right. I'm always that guy, it'll be okay. But they're like, nah, you're not okay. Like, you're bleeding a lot. You're bleeding. And I was like, started to look down, my arm was bleeding, my leg was just pure blood coming out. So they were like, get a strap. And I'm thinking, fuck, like, that is bad
right
now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there's no one there. Spain, there's no one at the tracks. You just turn up, right, there was no one. So they were, luckily the owner was there and we was like, ambulance. I called the ambulance. They're trying to wrap some old dirty rope around my leg to tighten it. And I'm like starting to panic now.
Yeah.
10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. And like at this point, I'm fading out. Like I'm looking at my mechanic, it was Sam Neat at the time. I just said, like, I'm done, mate. Like, fuck. That's it. I started to feel, like, a bit cold and just tired. I was like, no, I'm done. And I was like, he's like, don't go. And I was like, I'm trying, but I've got nothing more. Like, this is it. I accepted that was it. Then I was like, I closed my eyes. And I remember it was just, like, going quiet. And I was like, okay. And then I heard the ambulance. And that gave me, like, motive. Mm. And I was like, it's here. Am I hearing it? But it's here. Ambulance came straight in. Had to do blood transfusions straight away. They took me to the hospital and my season didn't even start. I was stuck in Valencia with, I had a piece of stone the size of my thumb that was pushed up to my pelvis.
Okay.
So they cleaned out all my femur, but they couldn't get this one piece out. And there was no rooms in this hospital. I was on the walkway because it was full, no English speaking. They opened the wound again, closed it, opened it. Closed it again. They said, can't get the stone out. I was there 2 days. I said, so what do? Do we leave it? Mm. Do we leave it in? And then I said, fuck, I need to go to Barcelona to the racing doctors, the GP at the time. And they said, we can't sign you off. I said, fuck, I need to go. I said, my leg's going to be amputated. Like, I need to go. And luckily, Tito Rabat was there at the time. And he was my translator helping me. And he's like, we're getting you out. So we organized like a private ambulance, which was more of like a van with a bed in the back. And basically signed me out and they were not agreeing with it. And he was saying all sorts of things in Spanish and he just pushed me out of there. I got in this van, straight down to Barcelona, 3 hours, no painkillers, on my own, some Spanish guy driving. I have no idea who he is and not a word of English. Yeah. Got into Barcelona, threw my credit card and insurance over the desk, straight rushed in. Then they had to reopen it again. So they opened it. The scar was like that. And then it was like this big all the way up my legs. They had to open it to take the stones out. And then I went into intensive care after it, because I lost so much blood. Then I come around, the guys did a good job, and I woke up to a phone call from Paul Bird saying, I think we should rip up the contract. You're no use to me. You know, God bless Paul, but he was straight to the point, and ruthless. I appreciate that. Yeah. Like, fair, but you know, at least give me some days. And from there, it was kind of crazy. Like, I was coming from a very depressive part of my life to trying to regain, and I'm sat in hospital going like, what did I do to deserve this?
Yeah.
But there's no answer to it. It was just on an Ovalle one day, and the top of the carburetor vibrated off, and then that caused that. And now I'm kind of regenerating my career, and I'm sat in hospital with a test in 4 weeks' time, and my team owner saying I'm no use to him, and the doctor telling me I need 8 weeks, and I'm telling him I ain't got 8 weeks. And I was back in 3 weeks and 4 days at the first test, and I topped the timesheets because I had to.
Bro, motorcycle riders are another level. There's so many of those similar type of stories out there as well.
Yeah.
But, okay, what struck me with that is how you said, like, everything was fading. Like, you felt like, okay. Mm-hmm. And you almost resigned to the fact that, okay, like, this could be it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you look at life differently? Like, is that like a moment in time where you think, fuck, like life's fleeting almost? Do you ever look back at that, or are you just like, nah, shut it off and move on?
Not really with that. Like, it was what it was. The one thing that made me struggle more was the incident with Tommy Zauer in 2008.
Yeah.
God bless, when he passed away. Obviously, I was involved in that accident. That was something that was like, is it worth it?
Mm.
You know, but I was still kind of young at the time, and a lot of people kept pushing me, and I was able to come through it. I was able to accept the situation it was, but that was quite hard, because that was within racing of that can happen at any time.
Mm.
You know, it was the same with the Simoncelli thing. Like, it was horrific. It was terrible, but it just sometimes can happen. And if you think about that, you ain't going to be a racer.
Yeah.
You know, sure, we think about it, but it's a matter of thinking, digest, let it go, and focus on your job.
Yeah.
Is, if not, better off staying at home.
It is. You're right. Like, it's, I don't want to say it's a part of it, but that, you know, the risk, and that's the risk you take.
Yeah.
And I guess everyone knows that. And, you know, you're all going to look out for each other as best as you can. You don't want to do anything crazy on the track either. Like, you don't want to put someone's life at risk. It's the last thing you want to do. But yeah, it's just, that's the scary thing of motorcycle racing. We were talking about that in the car on the way here. Like, people just don't understand how dangerous motorcycle racing really is. And then, like, you know, you go on the other end of the spectrum, you look at the Isle of Man guys, and they're another level again. Like, we had Cam Donald on, bro. He was like, I looked at myself every morning in the mirror and I said, I don't give a fuck if I die. I'm just like, we're like, what do you mean?
Bro, like, I have goosebumps with that. Like, that is insane.
Insane.
But like, you have to be that type of guy. Like, in my head, I try to always think, what must they think what they're doing? Like, John McGuinness, like, you have won multiple times. You are the god of the Isle of Man. You are the king of the king.
Yeah.
Why do you keep doing it?
Don't need, like, to do anymore.
But it must just be inside that I want to do it.
Yeah.
I do it for pleasure. I want to do it. There was the documentary, he's mowing, you know, he mows the garden, packs his bags. He says, maybe I don't come back. And I think, how can you think that, especially when you have a family at home?
Yeah,
the guys that are like rogue, you know, and they don't have families or whatever, they've come from a bad upbringing, for them there's nothing to lose, should we say. But the guys that have families, I find that, I'm going to say, I find it selfish in a way, because it's not about them. It's also when their family, like, if it goes wrong, which I hope never goes wrong for anyone, but the family have to then deal with that. And I find that quite selfish. And I have spoke with people about it. Like John McGuinness, I speak with him. He's a great guy. And I don't get it. But it's something inside of them that they do it because they love doing it. And I just think, how can you love doing that? It's not even, your mistake could be a problem. You could snap a chain. You could blow an engine. You could have a brake pad fall out. You could have something go wrong in the pit change. You could have a rabbit run out on you. Somebody could drop something because there's no barriers. You know, they're passing people half a meter with the phones hanging out. Anything, and it's done. like that. And you know, when you see the onboards now with the cameras inside the helmet, I know Peter Hickman does.
Yeah, it's nuts,
bro. Like that gives you a feeling of the Isle of Man TT.
It is terrifying. And like you look at McGuinness, the dude's so humble. Like one of the baddest people on the planet, if not the baddest, on a motorcycle. And like just an overweight dude that loves drinking Guinness and can just destroy anyone there.
Yeah. And that's the thing. He is the king. Like that is it. Like you're sure there will be people coming in the future, but it's the same thing at the Isle of Man. It's getting faster, faster. They're pushing more and more. You're going to have to start peeling it back at some point.
It has to be. The bikes just keep getting faster and faster. Like obviously they're just going to like tires keep getting better. Like,
yeah, but better tires means faster corner speed.
Yeah.
And the track layout and runoff has not changed from day dot.
Yeah.
They got faster, they're taking more risk, and they've got grippier tires. They got an airbag, that ain't going to do shit.
Nah.
You know, it's great, but it ain't going to do shit.
That light, they're hitting a light post at 260Ks now.
Ain't going to do it. It's the same thing with BSB now there. And then I think in Superbike, they're trying to slow it down a bit. They're trying to slow the bikes down, but the bike speed isn't the problem. The problem is the tires. Because when you crash, you're not crashing at top speed. You're crashing in the corners or in the braking. But like MotoGP, when I was there, you have so much grip. It's like a computer game. So then you go in the corner faster and harder. So when you crash, you go further. So it's not about the speed of the bike. I say to them, make the tires harder so we can't corner as hard. Mm. So we slow down and... you know, problem solved.
So you don't think it's like a, you know, with MotoGP, they're making it 850cc, whatever. Like
that'd be just as fast.
That's what everyone's saying. And I think they obviously try. I think they tried. They obviously did. Try it in like 2008 or 2007, 2008, and they're still fast and it's still dangerous. Like you're right. The top speed isn't where you're going to crash. It's the corners.
I mean, also like okay, they might not have the same top speed, but it will have better acceleration because the bike is lighter and now work with the power range. Mm. You know, there's so much technology. Mm. Like take all the fucking winglets and ride height device and all that stuff off and just bring it back to racing for a start. Like let's start there. I think they want to change it all for certain manufacturers. They are too far behind to try and start over again. Maybe some other manufacturers will come into the sport, which is always good.
Yeah.
You know, it's good that they do that. But they say it's about keeping the cost down. And I'm thinking, you're going to go and start a whole new bike.
Yeah.
You can't go put your 800 into the 1000cc chassis and the stiffness of the chassis will all change due to the torque of the bike and the weight of the engine. Like that whole thing, concept goes in the bin.
Yeah.
And you start over again. Yeah, you have data, you have calculations beyond what you can imagine, but you're still starting pretty much from scratch.
Yeah.
And there's all the money going in to make the best of it again.
It's a weird one. It was surprising when I saw it. Like, you're right, they just need to fuck off all the winglets. They look ugly, firstly, and then all the ride height devices. And like, there used to be, I think Jeremy Burgess used to say, there used to be a calculation. It used to be 80% rider, 20% bike.
Completely opposite.
It's opposite now, isn't it?
I said that today in the interview. It's 85% bike, the rest is rider. That's why you have the few percent at the top, and that makes it not interesting for me to watch.
Mm.
I would rather go and watch World Ducati Week when they're all on the same V4s and going head-to-head on the same bike. Like, that for me is racing. Like, the best racing I watch is, like, cup racing.
Yeah.
You go all get the same bike, let the best man win.
Yeah.
But there is, it comes on a level, and maybe there's certain people they want to have winning because in the end, it's a business. It's all about money.
Oh, you can always follow the money trail.
You always can. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole because it won't be good for me.
But yeah, fair enough.
There is, for me, there is a certain way how certain things will be.
Yeah, nah, it's probably been like that for a long time in multiple different sports at the same time. But you know, it's always refreshing, and you would know a lot about it. But you watch like Moto3 and there's. Like I find that to be amazing racing. Mm-hmm. Like eight different kids going into a top corner to then win a race. Like it's insane.
It is the best racing. It's like growing up, I always used to watch the 125s. Like as a family at home, we didn't care about MotoGP. Yeah, we'd like to get there one day, but it was about 125s. That was it. We literally was to watch that. It was the best racing. And it was just raw. It was just bikes. There's no electronic. You know everyone's getting the same tires, more or less. And they're just going for it bar to bar. Like, that is racing that you want to see.
At its purest form, it is.
Yeah, like two strokes, they were the days.
They were the days. So you were 125s and then to Moto2. Were you the last year of the 125s?
Yeah. So I was 2008, 2009. Mm. Praying for 250, like that was my golden era. That was my time.
Yeah.
And it just, it was gone. And then it was Moto2, and that was the end of the two strokes for me.
What's it like? What was it like jumping off a 125, then going onto a Moto2? Because it seems like from the outside that it's a big jump. Like, even like now to Moto3 to Moto2, it seems like a big jump.
Imagine the guys that went from 125 straight to GP. That's
wild.
I honestly thought it would never work because of what you're saying. When I went from 125 and I tested a 600 Moto2, I did like a half a day in Almeria on a Yamaha R6 stock bike. And then I tested the FTR. So it was like a tuned up engine, no exhaust. It was all straight through pipes. Fuck, bro. It was just revving its head like... And I was like hanging on like, fuck, this thing is so fast. It's crazy. And then like you kind of get used to it. But and I was thinking like when I jumped onto MotoGP, so I did a private test with Ducati the year before I was fighting for the title. I don't remember the year, but they invited me down. Can you test the bike? You know, don't do nothing stupid. I'm like, yeah, sure. You want to see if I'm capable or not? You know, I'm not born yesterday.
Yeah.
So I knew that was my time to show if I was capable or not. And I knew minimum I had to be faster than the test rider by a good chunk. So that was my goal. That was the year Rossi was there when the bike was just a...
Bucket of bolts. Was it that bad?
I had nothing to compare it to.
Yeah, fair enough.
For me, it was just fuckloads of horsepower.
Yeah, yeah.
And just try and tame it. Like, there's a lot... What I tried to do for 2 days. After the first day, my hands, my arms, my shoulders, my neck, I had, like, so much pain because I was terrified. It took me 5 laps to get down to sixth gear in the straight.
No shit.
Because that thing had, like, the anti-wheelie was not that good. It was just fucking, you open it, it was just, and it just didn't end. You shift the next gear, it's like wheeling again. I'm like, what the fuck's going on? That Mugello, end of the straight, you go right, left, over.
Yeah.
Bro, when I was going over there the first lap, I was thinking, fuck, Scott, this is your time to shine. Fucking got to do it. One of those things, I didn't want to do it, but I had to do it. Fifth, sixth. Fucking closed one eye, going over the crest left, and it wheeled, and it whoom, like, because it spins over the top, because you actually get a bit of air. And as that happened, like, as the bike pulled itself down, I was out the seat, and he sucked me off the back of the bike. I'm like, fuck, like, how do you ride this thing? Exit the left, right chicane, and I'm like gripping the bike, trying to grip the tank with my chin, and it's just pulling, like, it's endless pull. Like, you want 1,000cc, like, first, second, you're like, fuck, it's pulling.
Yeah.
Well, imagine that on steroids, and then also when you hit sixth, you have that same kick.
Fuck.
It never neutralizes, you know, like it just pulls and pulls and pulls, and it just terrified the life. And I'm thinking, well, I think it was Jack Miller was one of the first guys to go from Moto.
Yeah.
I was like, there is no way. It is not going to work. I was like, it's going to be a massive disaster. Like, I don't know how he got his head around it. I know he's pretty wild.
Like, yeah.
You know, he's out there, but... Fuck, bro, it was impressive. I never rode anything like that ever again in my life. Wow. It was just a torpedo on wheels. Everything else around it, don't worry about it.
Just pure power. It's like being, I heard a funny quote, it's like being slapped in the back by God.
Yeah, multiple times. They said, oh, can you do a practice start? So like I'm sat on this 1,000cc, sounds like a 2,000cc bike, you wants to rip your head off. Like, I don't know how I feel about this. I'm literally, you're getting it and you're going, and the thing's just so loud and everything's popping and banging and vibrating. Fucking let the clutch out. Massive wheelie. I'm like, fuck. Second gear, back brake, bosh. Second gear. I'm like, fuck. Third gear, down. Up again at the sky, third. Fourth. I'm like, fuck. Slammed it. I'm like, what just happened? My life flashed before my eyes. I came in. And I was like, what on earth just happened? I don't know what happened. They're like, we don't have anti-wheelie for the start. I was like, yeah, thanks for letting me know. Yeah, I just found out. So all that power, And the guys obviously manage it with the throttle and with the brake. Like, you start on the limiter, but then you can play with the throttle and the rear brake. We didn't, in Moto 2, you're just pinned and you go. So, like, I had no idea. I just fucking let it all go and it just let loose, bro. Like, it terrified me.
Fuck.
Fourth gear, and then I thought, nah, that's enough. Like, yeah. Let's just come back.
Man, 100%. Like, they just looked, like, that Ducati as well just looked aggressive. And obviously, it was a hard bike to ride if you're a professional, because, yeah, we didn't have the best results, let's just say, for a long time, let's be honest. Like, it was a weird, Ducati's a weird situation, because, like, Casey came in there and no one expected him to do anything, blew everyone away.
Yeah, but he is just somewhat special.
That's what everyone says. That's what everyone says.
He is more talent than the top five guys put together.
It's like, amazing.
The things you see him do as a spectator, you don't appreciate it as we do as riders.
Yeah.
Like, you see Toprak do some things and you're like, fuck. But you see some of the things that Casey does and you're like, first, how? Mm. And so consistent. I don't believe he had fear. I don't believe he feared anything of crashing. He just went.
Yeah.
And it will be what it will be. And he was just like, angry. Angry to win. Like, nothing else mattered. Like, he didn't give a fuck. Like, the stories I've heard of him when he was young, he signed for like KTM, and they're like, okay, I think it was Estoril, can you just go out, we make running in the engine, I think it's 125s or 250s running the engine, yeah, to just take it easy, went down pit lane, rah, high side, came in, went out two laps later, rah, crash, like, just no forgiveness on it. Yeah. It was like, I'm going out, I'm going to be fast, and that's it. Like, that guy used to crash, come in, go out, first flying lap, red helmet.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah,
you
yeah.
just had a huge crash, and now you're going even faster. Like, at least one lap. Not Casey, bro. Just go in.
Fuck, that's insane. And, like, it's so many people we've spoken to have said basically the same thing. Just how much natural talent that dude has. And he just, I've never met him, but just from the outside, he just seems like a quite unassuming dude that doesn't really want to talk to anyone. He beats to his own drum. Like,
he is not a people person. No. I don't think. Well, maybe in close.
Yeah.
But he's not a big people person. He don't care about all the bullshit of media. That's not his thing, and fair play to him. And he made it known. Like, some people are different and you have to respect that. But he got hate for that.
Yeah.
Which was a bit unfair, really. Like, in the end, he's there doing his job. You know, but he looked at it as, he must have looked at it just like war in his head with the racing. Like, nothing else mattered between him and the bike. So all the fans and stuff, he didn't care, but then he got hated on. And then social media, it was the start of social media times. Like, it's hard. Like, the shit that people say, and you can say, oh, I don't care. Like, you still read it, still sitting, they are talking about you. And then sometimes you maybe think, and if you're someone that can't take that very well, it's a nasty place to be. And I have massive respect for him from doing what he was doing and then just hung up the suit, like, I'm done, bye.
Wild. And like, it would have been crazy to see him against Mark as well.
Insane.
But like, it's a, if only, yeah, like, he had a lot of issues as well. Like, he had all those health issues that he rode through, like chronic fatigue or whatever it was, like, you know. And then he jumps on the Repsol Honda and then just blasts everyone.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, it didn't seem to matter to him about the bike. You know, like, most, like, including myself, I thought I could ride any bike, and that got shown up real quick last few years at BMW. I just can't ride that type of bike, which I'm not afraid to say. I thought I could ride every bike, turns out I can't. Him, he will just make it work. I think there's a documentary on Stoner on YouTube or maybe something. I watched some about it, and they were talking about when he was in 250s and he was on an old bike and he was just crashing the brains out of it because he refuses for it not to work. And he just crashed, but you get faster, crash faster, just crash. And I just think, bro, but Mark is the same sort of guy. Like, that's why watching them two battle would be insane, because Mark learned from Casey. Mark looked at all of Casey's data. Like, when you go to a team or manufacturer, you kind of pick your guy. Like, okay, I want to see a bit what he's doing. from what I heard, Mark was just stoner. Yeah. And you see Mark, he rides like stoner.
I was going to say, from your point of view, his riding style, whatever, mm-hmm. is like Casey. Because you see him sometimes like, fuck, it does look like Casey Stoner.
Yeah. Or just the way he brakes with the bike and then the way he slides, like turn three, Phillip Island, the way Mark does it. I'm pretty sure he studied that for months to do it. But he studied it to do it, and that's how he wants to ride. Like, if you put them both in a black suit, I'd be able to tell you, but it'd be pretty fucking hard who was who. You know what I mean? Just the way they ride, the way he picks up the bike, the way he attacks the corner, in detail you see it, and it's like, that is like a stoner junior.
Yeah, it's wild. And now Marquez is an old man in the paddock. Like, hey, where's time gone?
We're the same age. Yeah, we were the youngsters.
Yeah, once upon a time.
Yeah, we have a month between us, I think. So we was always the youngsters, and... Oh, you're young. You know, you got time. You know, I was the youngest in 125.
I was
the youngest in Moto 2. I was pretty young in GP. And now it's like some years ago, you know, your manager says you're not quite the young guy anymore. And I'm like, fuck, yeah, you're right. Now I'm 32. I got a baby. Mark's 32. I mean, he's still at the top of his game. You know, this year is going to be impressive to watch. Like, I'm so happy he jumped ship.
Okay, yep.
Because you can see how painful it is for him, because he's like Stoner, he's relentless. Yeah. That's why he had them massive crashes, because he didn't care. Like, he wants to win that bad. He will do that every weekend.
His crashes were fucking insane.
Like, and then he gets up again and bounces. Goes again. But that's the mentality side. Yeah. And I just thought, like, it's not fair on you. And when he signed a contract to do Cal, I messaged him and I was like, bro, I'm so happy. You are gonna absolutely love it.
Yeah.
And I'm happy he went to Gresini. And you got to saw Marc Márquez.
Yeah.
You know, I always said, like, he was always covered what to do. Like, the guy's had the same hairstyle since he was probably 12. Hasn't changed. Like, that's the thing. And when he was there, he got a bit of freedom.
Yeah.
And it was good to see dancing on the podium. Yeah. Racing needs that. And he was allowed to do that. Whether we see that now, maybe is a little bit different. But it was good for him to have that fun year in the bank. And that brought him back to enjoy racing. And then, you know, getting that seat on the factory Ducati, I think he's going to be hard to beat, I think, once he gets dialed.
That's the thing. Like, it's such an interesting prospect of what's going to happen this year in, obviously, the Grand Prix bikes. Like, I still think personally that Márquez has definitely the most speed and the most talent in that paddock. Like, it's proven, but I just think, like, if he can just stay on that bike and bring back 2019 Marc Márquez, which I still think he has, then he could potentially wipe the floor. But, like, you know, you look at Bagnaia, he's still a star, and Martin's a star, but he's jumped on that Aprilia, and who knows, man?
The Ducati is a very good bike. So there's a few things that I believe will happen. You know, touch wood, Marc shouldn't crash as much, because he's not overriding the limit. Like, that Honda was not supposed to be where he was finishing, hence where everyone else was finishing. Yeah. So first, he's not going to have to push as much. So he's going to have a little bit in the pocket, should we say. Shouldn't crash that much. Bagnaia, I don't know how he's going to handle Mark in the garage.
Well, that's the interesting one, isn't it?
Because I noticed something that maybe many people didn't, but Mark come in with all red. And Pecco Bagnaia was the all red guy. Red helmet, red gloves, red boot. Mark came in with the all red boots, gloves, helmet, number. And now at testing, Bagnaia's shifted away from the red, black gloves, black boots. So there's a little bit of mind games in behind with Mark, in my opinion, whether it was on purpose or not. But I would say there was a bit of summit there. Like, this is my team now.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I don't know how Bagnaia's going to... That was my watch. Bagnaia's going to kind of take that. I mean, he's a fucking amazing rider.
Yeah.
But pressure is a hard thing for everybody. Like, Mark just had the time of his life last year. Like, he was just playing. You know, he knows. Imagine how he feels. Like, I'm on this old bike and I'm racing with you guys. Yeah. Like, it was just fun.
Yeah.
And now he's got that bike he wanted. You know, Martin jumping on the Aprilia, it can go real well or real bad. You know, the Aprilia has come a long way. Yeah. But to step away from the Ducati to that is, it's going to be an interesting one. And obviously having that, he had two crashes within the first half a day, right? Because he crashed before he had the big one.
Yeah, he did.
So the confidence.
Just before.
Yeah. So the confidence, where is it at?
I know. And then, like, if he's going to then he's just going to go straight to Buran to race, and he's had like one test.
It's going to be a hard year, but he's a talented guy. He's got speed, he's got grit, but I don't think it's going to be as easy what he's
going. You're going up against like Marquez and Bagnaia on those factory Ducatis. Like, that's a team and a half, and the only thing you know that might help him is they're going to take points away from each other, I guess. But I don't know. I still can't. If Marquez just as you said, stays on that bike, man, he's a hard man to be. He knows the battle of winning a championship. He knows the mind games of it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's as you know, like it's all still in between the ears.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%.
It's wild. We're very excited. We're going to round one. And it's going to be a big. Big week there. And then we go to Phuket afterwards and party for a bit, so
go get it. Be rude not to,
mate. You're there, like, geez, what else are we gonna do? Have you been to Buran?
Yeah,
the racetrack.
I think was it no I did Chang was it
Chang is that the same thing
it could be
I think it's the same thing.
Yeah, I did it the first year they started going back to Thailand.
Yeah, right.
Is there on the Aprilia we tested and we raced. That hot, I spewed in my helmet with two laps to go.
No shit. Oh, Tom's not going to want to hear that. He's freaking out about the heat. It's that hot.
Well, it was hot when we were there.
Yeah, it's going to be hot.
I remember I was battling for points on the Aprilia. That was a big deal for me.
that's a podium.
And I was breaking into the last corner against Bradley Smith. So it was like a Brit rivalry as well. And I was like dying from the heat. It was so hot. Them bikes run hot. You're physically giving everything, especially on that thing. I was remember breaking. I was like, oh, that don't feel good. Spewed up in the house. I've never had that in my life, bro. It's insane.
Fucking hell.
It's crazy. Like, we race in such hot conditions. Like, it's not normal. We did, what was that race we did? We did Jerez.
I was going to say Jerez in like 2020 or 2021. Yeah.
So I won two of those races and it was 42 degrees and I went out to the warm-up lap for the first race and I wore no undersuit because I thought less layers, less heat. Like we're in survival mode. So I go out for the warm-up lap and the heat's going through and it's like burning my skin because you've got the heat of the bike as well, you know, like running at 100 degrees. And I get to the grid. I said, Gio, I said, we can't race in that, bro. Like that just was burning me. And he looked around. He goes, everyone else is going to race.
Fuck.
I said, looks like we're racing, baby. And I come away with the win from there. So that was kind of cool.
That's awesome.
I've been known as a guy that can't race in heat because I haven't finished two races when I was younger. And to come back and win the hottest recorded race was kind of a big deal for me. It was really good. And then, so we did that. And then we raced in Imola last year, 2 years ago. We did that 1 year at Imola.
That's cool.
And that was hot. It was like 38, 39, but high humidity. Yeah. And you're in like the town. So town's always hotter. And it was like super hot. People started like passing out in the paddock and stuff. And then they like shortened the race. And I'm like, so you shortened this race. Yeah. But like in Jerez, when it was even hotter, we didn't shorten the race. So now they're starting to like shorten races and stuff. But why go to those places when it's so hot? Like, I think like for the safety commission, you're hot stood there. Mm. Think about us in full gear with a bike running at 100 degrees underneath us, not designed for the heat to go away. Yeah. Heat only goes up. It's all aero and we are physically exerting ourselves. Like when I'm racing, my heart rate's like 170 and my max is 180 in any training I do. So I am absolutely redlined for 30 minutes with all that gear on, all the heat, the helmet.
And you're behind other bikes. Like if you're behind, then you got all the exhaust fumes anyway.
Eye burn that you get. Like in MotoGP, I used to, my eyes used to burn. You have to put eye drops in all the weekend. Because you got your vents open, but you like when your head's out and you're kind of you're 2 meters, sometimes a meter from the exhaust, and that's just blowing in your face. And I used to burn like your eyes and stuff.
That's stuff like I would never think of, like, you would never think
no
about
one
that.
No one speaks about it because we forget about it the moment we finish.
Yeah, well, like, no one does speak about it, you're right. Like, and then I never thought that,
but we're not pussies, like,
nah.
We just, that's what it is and that's what it will be. We know it's going to be hot. We know we're going to suffer and after it will be what it will be. We get a little ice bath and crack on with your day. You know, it's just, that's how it is.
Yeah.
That's the cool bit of racing we spoke about earlier. That's what we're going to start to miss over time, but it's the rawness I like.
The rawness. Talk to me about World Superbikes. The calendar, it's all through Europe and then there's Australia. Should it be, do you think it should be more spread out?
So it's more like a European championship with a wild card at Australia.
Yeah, we got the Aussie wild card.
It's always nice doing the first round in Australia because it's just what it's been for years. And it's kind of nice. The bad thing is we all gear up for the start of the season and then we have a month off.
Yeah, which is strange as well.
So all the testing is in like January and then February we're here, you know, and it's like then we have a month off and then we get going again. Like that doesn't make sense to me. And also it's World Superbike.
Yeah,
it was European plus Australia Superbike. Reality is, and this is what we're talking about. So, also like not racing in Japan, and you got brands, you know, Kawasaki, Honda, Yamaha. Like to go to Japan would be massive for them. I don't know why they don't do it. It's I don't know if it's a money thing. You know, went to Thailand. It was great. You know, it was
for sure
really good. Just certain things don't really sit well with me, like. They never promote World Superbike.
Man, 100%.
You never see anything anywhere.
100%.
Why? I have a question. Why? I don't know the answer, but why? Then you go to the races, and let's take Thailand, because that's one that stuck out to me. I kind of made friends with a couple of locals there. Some guy that took me to saw the monkeys, got nothing, you know, hung out with him. I bought him a couple of drinks, just started talking, because I like to get to know people that. It's cool. And he's like, oh, the racing is really good. I'd love to go. I said, come on, let's go. Oh, I can't. I have to work and the tickets. And I said, oh, how much are the tickets? He said, oh, it's unbelievable. I said, what, like, what unbelievable? He said, for a normal guy working two jobs, he was working at the hotel and he would have to have another job for 2 months to pay for one ticket.
Fuck. So it's just super unaffordable.
So, but why would you do that? There was thousands of people there that was begging to watch.
Yeah.
So they were like, there's a big rock mountain type of thing. You see people taking pictures at before, you know, and you can see the whole track. And they had full police squad stopping people going up there to watch from outside the circuit, stopping people looking over the walls.
Mm.
And I'm thinking, why would you do that? Surely you would reduce the price to something affordable, bring the fans in to the paddock and the grandstands and make more of a show. But you don't do that. All the grandstands are half empty all the time. Yeah. Why? It doesn't make sense why they do it. So that I don't understand. I don't know if it's like they don't want Superbike to become bigger than MotoGP, because a lot of people you speak to go, MotoGP is not that interesting anymore because you know what's coming.
Mm.
Superbike, I think it was especially the first year I came back to Superbike, Johnny'd been running away with it. Then all of a sudden there was a battle. It was like me, Top Rack, Jonathan, and then always there'd be someone else kind of kicking around. And you didn't know who was going to win the race. And they said the viewing numbers just like skyrocketed. And then all of a sudden, it all starts changing a little bit. And I don't know why they don't want to push it, but I'm guessing it's to do with that a little bit.
I don't get it, man, because like, yeah, you can get these numbers in. And I think Southeast Asia is a massive market.
Huge.
And they love, and they relate to bikes. They all ride bikes, so they relate to it. And like it's World Superbikes, like they should be going to like Thailand or Sepang, you know, Laguna Seca or Coda. Like get the American market's massive, and the Americans have got such rich history as well in World Superbikes. Like it's more of a spectacle. It gets all you riders back around the world. Like I think it's definitely what's needed. I don't think it should just be going to, you know, most Czech Republic or no offense to that track, but like,
but it's true, we are starting to race on non-Grand Prix circuits
100%,
you know, like, and I'm not against it in a way. I kind of think it's cool.
Yeah, you
know, it's different tracks. Like if Superbike goes to Jerez, then MotoGP goes to Jerez. Most of the people, if they're going to spend the money, they're going to spend it on MotoGP because it's MotoGP. It's like Formula One, they're going to do it. So if we go to race in Spain, let's go race somewhere else, like Navarra. Yeah, it's small, it's bumpy, but fuck, it's different. Mm. Like I enjoy that. I think it's a better thing to do. Then there was this big thing that Superbike was coming too close to GP because they were doing better lap times in the winter with the qualifying tire. But it should still be a world championship. Like you say, going around, going to Laguna Seca, you know, now MotoGP is not going there. Like let us go back there. And it should be that way, but I can't put my finger on as to why.
I would love it. Like, it's needed. And I remember looking at the calendar. I think it was last year. And I'm like, where the fuck's all the other tracks? Like, yeah. It's just Europe and Australia. It's such a strange thing. And as you said, like Japan, I didn't even think about Japan. You got all these Japanese manufacturers, like they have to go there. Like, I don't know.
A lot of them base their factories over in Spain.
Yeah, makes sense.
For that reason. Yeah. But like, surely they'd want to have them in their home country to do it. But they don't. Same, like, a lot of it's in Spain, and like, get kind of pissed off racing in Spain. I've done it most of my life. Yeah. Like, let's go somewhere else. Like the whole thing with Hungary, I'm fucking buzzing for it. Like,
yeah, okay.
A new track is like kid in a candy store. Whether it happens or not is a different story.
The Spanish man have they kind of own it at the moment. Like, it's a weird one. It goes through stages, but it seems like if that's where you want to be in motorcycle racing, Spain's the place, especially in Grand Prix.
Yeah, well, that's what I did. I went to Spain. I was in France, then I went to Spain. Like, if you stay in the UK, like, the age cap is so high on anything, you can't move up the categories. That's why we went to Spain, because I was told I can't race here, I can't race there. But I was racing and I was dominating everything, and I was learning nothing. Mm. From what my dad said, he's like, if you're winning, you're not learning. I was like, okay. So he was always trying to find races where I would get beat. I was racing in France. I was like 13. I was meant to be 15. No, I wasn't, because I was in Spanish Championship at 13. So I was 12. I was 11, and I was supposed to be 13. Fuck. So we forged a birth certificate for a French Championship, and I was racing against adults, and I was being beat. I was winning, but it was not an easy thing. Ended the championship when I won the championship, and then we told them I forced the birth certificate. They kind of laughed and then took the trophy off us and said, okay, we can't have it. But we had to do what we had to do to be the best we can be. Otherwise, you go stagnant and you don't improve anymore. When you're young, it's so important to be always learning. Because the moment you stop learning, the boat is always moving. And this is what I when I had the interview earlier today, I was speaking about me coming back to Ducati, you know, and like a lot of people expected me to jump on and be on it straight away. I thought also that could be the case, but the top guys have all moved. Yeah. It's all moved on. Like, I've been sitting around 10th position for the past 3 years and I've been learning nothing. Mm. I've been stagnant. Now I'm on a good bike I can be competitive with, but the guys have moved the goalposts. So from what I thought was fast, that's not fast anymore, bro. Like, you need to step up the game a little bit. And, you know, I'm fortunate I can see data and stuff, but it's moving all the time. I've had bad years. I thought, if I have a year out, regroup, you know, come away from it and come back. But then it's like, you have a year out, it's going to be so hard to come back. Everything just moves so fast.
100%. Like, you can be forgotten about real fucking quick.
And you're as good as your last race.
Yeah.
As soon as you retire, no one cares.
Yeah, it's interesting.
All these riders that have not really made anything in their career, like, they've been good, but they've not won races, or, you know, never been a highlight. Soon as they retire, like, gone. Forgotten about.
Forgotten, man.
I see guys at track days that I used to race with. I'm like, oh, fuck, you're still riding? Oh, yeah, I'm doing German Championship. I'm doing that. Oh, that's fucking cool, but I didn't know.
Yeah.
It's weird.
It is weird. And, like, that's the thing with riding. You gotta, I guess, like, you have to still market yourself. And I want to talk to you about British Superbikes. Oh, no, sorry. I want to talk to you about being English in Grand Prix.
Mm-hmm.
I think of English riders and I think of you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's so much English talent, but not a lot of it makes it to Grand Prix. Is it because BSB is so strong and a lot of English talent want to ride British Superbikes and go into Superbikes? Because you guys dominated World Superbikes for a long time.
No, I don't think so. Because it all happens long before that. It all happens because in my day, you need to be going to Grand Prix at 15, 16. If you ain't 15, 16, you're close to missing the boat. At 17, 18, forget it.
Yeah.
There's a small window. So to get the timing of that right is already hard. But to be an English guy to go to Grand Prix, you need to be a lot of money, or you've got to have a lot of talent and a lot of dedication, hard work. Like, them two, they go a long way.
Mm.
I was never fortunate enough to have money. That was the issue I had. I had to kind of go off of dominating everything I did to kind of give no option, basically. And I just feel like a lot of the kids now, especially now, they don't have that dog in them. Mm. Like, it's a fun thing. And I think, like, back in the day, like, I used to get beat hard. Like, if I didn't ride well, I used to get beat. And you hear that with a lot of riders, you know, older than me. It was not fun to us. Fun was winning. It's like now, for me, winning is fun. Winning is what I do it for. But getting there, like, if I was not riding well and my dad drove 5 hours to go race and I decided I didn't really want to race because I was a kid, like, I'd get slapped about and then I'd go and win. And that turned into be the recipe of doing it. But now, kids are, you can't touch me. Yeah. Like, I know my rights. You can't do that. Like, I own the house. Kids generally think they own the house. Like, back in my day, I didn't own the house. If my dad said jump, I said how high. You know, and that's the way it is. Like, we were hardcore, basically. That's what we had racing in us. And now I don't see many people with that. The only guy that I see with that at the moment coming up is Casey O'Gorman. He's an Irish kid. He actually came to my Scott Redding Young Riders Academy when he was 3 or 4.
Yeah, wow.
On a little bladder thing.
Yeah.
But fast. He was fast straight away. Ruthless. Didn't think, don't care about crashing. He's racing in Junior World Championship right now. He's been pretty good. But again, no money. Just going off of, like, hard work. His dad has been grafting, driving to Spain to and from. Been kicked out of teams because he doesn't agree with what they're doing. We went through all of that. Like, I know what you're going through, and what you're doing is the right path. That's why you're in the 1% and you're in Spanish Championship and you're fighting for podiums and no one else is. Because being the nice guy doesn't get you nowhere if you don't have the dough. If you got the dough, you know, you can do what you want. Money talks. And that's why it won't happen anymore, because the kids are not, they're not built like that anymore. They're all soft.
They don't have that C-U-N-T in them.
No, they don't. Like, the stuff I do in training, the things I say to myself, like,
yeah.
It make you think I'm not wired up right. But that's what you have to do. I don't have money to go, okay, like, whatever. And if you got the money, you get comfortable. But I like them guys with the talent and the rawness. And that's, I went through that path and I would never change that.
That's interesting. That's a very, very interesting take. And yeah, you're right. Like, you see, like, it's a hard one, because you see talent in any sport normally, and I'm not going to say every time because it's not, but a lot of the greats, like, come from nothing because they got to grind. Like, whether it be Michael Jordan, we always use him as an example here, like, got cut from his basketball team, had the high school basketball team, had no money. Work ethic was next level. Mike Tyson came from, like, the most depraved backgrounds to then become a killer at 20 years old and a world, like, the heavyweight champion of the world in boxing, like, crazy. And you see these people, these greats of sport or whatever, they have kids and they grow up in privilege and they never normally amount to anything, because it's a lot harder when you're sleeping in silk sheets.
Yeah, it is, but why would you want your kid to go through that?
True. That's, you know, that's
look at Conor McGregor. The guy came from nothing, from building site. And he said what he wanted to do and he did it. And he is living his life. And yeah, he might be taking drugs. He might be doing this. But you know what? He's got more money than he knows what to do with. Like, he doesn't need to do it anymore. Like, why do you want to get your head kicked in when you're living on a yacht, you know, sipping proper 12 whiskey, you know? Like, you don't need to be doing that. But you put your, like, you know, Mike Tyson, where he just came from nothing. It was rough. It was hard. Like, that just, your DNA is just different. You put him in a ring with a guy that has not come from that, he's going to walk through him, bro. Yeah, like, mentally, he's already destroyed him. Like, he was ferocious. He was a killer. And they sensed that. That's why they didn't even stand a chance. Yeah. Bro, I watched all of his fights. Like, it was insane, the mentality he had. Like, he was wild. Like, he's literally not wired up right. Is the shit that he's done and the things he's been through is because he is just an absolute outright savage. But people get to see it because he's on TV around the world, and you see those guys, and it does bring out a better person. They're just not politically correct, which now, this day and age, makes it difficult
for sure.
You know, I had to change a lot. I was that guy. I just said what I wanted and I didn't care. And I fucking got myself in a lot of trouble. But it was who I am. And then I'm thinking, well, if I want to continue my career, if I want to do this, then I need to kind of balance it. It's not what I want to do, but it's what I kind of have to do because that's the way we are. But in the fighting game, you know, you be you and go do you, bro.
Bro, yeah, the fighting game's wild. Like, those guys say some... Bryce Matthews came out and said some wild shit on his podcast. It's crazy. And that's the good thing about, like, I love the UFC and I've always been a big fan of it from the long that, like, a long time ago, like, when Fedor Emelianenko was running through everyone in Pride. But, like, the good thing at UFC is Dana White obviously controls it and everyone can kind of speak their mind and it's entertaining. And that's what's missing in a lot of motorsport as it is people can't speak their mind and they're bound by sponsors. And you touched on it before. You look at Mark Marquez, he had a free year at Cristini and he was dancing. He was being a bit more of himself and people relate to that. People just want to find someone that they relate to. And then if you're just bound by whatever sponsor, let's just say Monster Energy or whatever, like, yeah, you know, they say you can't do this, this and this. It's like, well, fuck, what can I do?
When I went to BSB, now you've said that, I remember getting a message from Stuart Higgs after it was all signed. I was going there and I was like, what's the rules? Like, can I be a bit me? He's like, 100% you be you. You go all out. I was like, fuck, like, this is perfect. And I could be that guy. Like, people wanted me to fail because they expected me to be the glamorous MotoGP superstar. Mm. You get labeled a superstar because you're in the same game. But I'm not that guy. I'm definitely not that guy at all. But it took me a while to not convince people, just to get them to understand that I'm quite raw. I love racing, like hardcore love racing. And I want to go out and do my best and I'll do anything I can more or less to win. But like, it's so like rogue there that I fit in better than any other championship. Like, Monster Energy was my sponsor. They loved that I was doing the wild shit.
That's cool.
You know, they embraced it. Like, oh, do you want us to bring the truck up to the motorhome with the speakers? Fuck, I had people on top of the motorhome. Like, we had fires in there and like people jumping off shit. And like, they loved it because it was like, it fitted to the environment.
Yeah.
We were doing like some stage thing where you throw stuff and a few riders there. And like, for them, maybe because it's like, they don't want to do wrong. They're very conservative. But for me, it was like a step to the side. And if it all went wrong, fucked anyway. But like, I was like throwing the shit in the crowd, took my shirt off, threw my shirt in the crowd. And I thought, fuck this, dive bombed in the crowd. I was crowd surfing and like, people love that. And then like sometimes on the Saturday night, I'd go up to the bar in the paddock where a lot of the punters were. I'd be in there like dancing and stuff. And like, Scott Redding, what you done, bro? And just having a little dance, like just chilling. And then like more and more people was like, actually, like, he's for real. He just loves being at racing. Yeah. And at the end of the year when I won the championship, I had so many people saying, you know what? I want to shake your hand because I didn't want you to succeed, or I thought you was like a superstar, but you are real. And like, that made me feel good because I was able to prove to people that the actual person that I was. And yeah, we just had a mental year at BSB. Like, it was insane.
Must have been such a cool feeling winning that title though.
There was so much on the line, because for me, if I didn't win the championship, I was staying in BSB.
Yeah.
My only card, win or stay there. And I don't know the tracks, didn't know the bike, didn't know the tires, fucking didn't know anything. I'm riding on tracks that I would never even think about riding. I have no time to learn the tracks, like, so much pressure. But to pull it off was like, it was a dream. You know, it was like, I just actually couldn't believe it actually happened.
Wild.
And you know, it was something that I'll always take with me. It was one of those years that was just phenomenal, you know, start to finish. I had up days, bad days. You know, I got took out by Irwin twice. We nearly had a fight on the sidelines. You know, video went quite viral. But that was part of it. Yeah. Like, they embraced that. You know, I was just thinking, don't punch him, don't punch him, don't punch him. But you know what? I think if we had a bit of a tussle, like,
beef,
we'd have got a slap on the hand, but put aside. But yeah, you do that in World Championship, you get banned.
Yeah, that's it. That's
you know, it. And that was in my head at the time, but it was kind of cool. Then you're like talking about after, I'm like, no, like, you fucked up, stop lying. And we're like having this discussion, and you know, he says his point, I say mine. You know, now you know, nothing bad to say about him. You know, he, I don't know if he's dirty rider or he just doesn't know, but his riding style is just quite aggressive. And what the respect thing, you know, you said about riders' respect.
Mm.
We're on tracks that are very dangerous. Certain places you don't overtake or you don't push someone off the track. Like in his head, I don't know if he doesn't realize it, but he just goes for it anyway. And that was my point. Like, there's no need for doing that. At Cadwell Park, why are you dive bombing me from, I think, like 30 meters away, and I'm one of the latest breakers anyway, and you're going to try and outbreak? How do you think that's going to work?
Yeah.
You know, you come off the track and you're looking at a tire wall thinking, you know, and it's just the respect thing wasn't there. But now, you know, we've kind of cleared the dust and
buried the hatchet a little bit.
All good, bro. It's good.
Those BSB tracks are pretty insane. Like, I think it's the best domestic championship in the world is British Superbikes, and the talent that comes through it. And then, like, you see it, you see World Superbikes and the amount of how the English are going there. But, bro, those tracks, they're fucking wild.
They're just scared the fucking shit out of me.
Bro, and it's like some of it, there's really no runoff.
No, like nothing.
Yeah. Like, you can't crash there.
No, I remember first time I went to Alton Park and I was riding around thinking, what the fuck have I done? I did the first lap with Stuart in the safety car. Sorry, we did the first corner and I was like, where's the air fence? He's like, you won't hit the wall down. Like, but there's not even gravel. And we're coming in there third gear in the corner. So we're coming in there fifth, back to third, bump in. It's all good. Like, and I'm like, all right, this is what I'm dealing with. Like, I got to just take it and don't ask questions.
Yeah.
And I was riding, you're going up over Clay Hill, fifth gear, and you've got to roll at the right time or you lose the rear. And you go into this left, right. And I ran wide one time and I was looking at the wall thinking, fuck. And my brain was fixating on the wall. And I was telling myself, lean the bike, lean the bike, lean the bike. And I'm trying to go straight and I'm leaning. I'm like, fuck, I'm leaning. I just stayed on the track like that much. And at that moment, I made the decision, like, you either need to be scared or you need to just love it. And I was like, I need to just love it. And from then I was like, okay, I'm going to be scared. Like, that excited me. I was racing scared because I'm not riding it on a track day going, oh, I take my time. I'm going out in FP1, then FP2, qualifying race.
Yeah.
I need to get up to speed now. So I used to go out first and just try and follow people. But, you know, like Josh Brooks, he's got years of experience there. Right. And like he's going in and I'm fucking tipping into this corner. I have no idea if there's bumps or whatever. Then I'd like build up speed. But I was constantly scaring myself. You got like Alton Park, we did a test, a whole round there and a second round. And it was the last five laps of the second round, I relaxed and said, I know where I'm going.
Jesus.
All the other ones, I'm like, oh, is it there? Oh, is it there? Oh, like the whole time. And then you're fucking racing with these guys. Cadwell.
Bro. I know. The leap, man. That's just... Bro, there's a lot of amazing footage there, but fuck, like on a super bike.
You need to go there to witness it, to appreciate it. I went there to do a track day, so I thought I need to kind of figure out, because that one was quite a bad one on the list, you know. It was the one that scared me the most. You have a lot of stories there. There's a lot of bad stuff happened. And I turned up there, and I was with Fraser Rogers, one of my mates. He races BSB. And we were signing on, and I said, where the fuck's the track? He goes, it's there, bro. I went, no, that's the pit lane. He goes, that's the track. I said, no way. He said, look, there's the pit lane. I swear to God, the pit lane is that wide.
Shit.
And the track, it looked like a pit lane. Yeah. Grand Prix pit lanes are bigger than the track at Cadwell Park. And I went out and I was just like, fuck, bro. Like the Yarmco's there. You're up, down, it's bumped. There's like going into turn one, there's no curb on the outside of braking. It's white line, grass.
Yeah.
No room for error. And I watched them guys last year there. And they are like that from the grass, each lap.
It's wild, man. There's something in the DNA with you guys just with those tracks because, you know, like, you're right. There's no room for error. Do you think, though, that makes you, like, doing that year made you a better rider on those tracks?
I'm not sure if it was the tracks, but riding with no electronic, for sure.
Yeah.
And I love that. Like, that's how racing should be.
Yeah.
No electronics. Like, just ride the bike. And it brings out the riders, and that's why you have different manufacturers winning there, because it's a leveler playing field. And I really appreciated that, and that did build me up on like throttle control and also like wheelie control, because when you have anti-wheelie, you just hold it and do whatever, but with that you had to really manage it. And then you could bring that over to when I went to superbike, everything was easier for me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, things got easier because there was more control and stuff on the bike. And for sure, like, it was a fun time. And, you know, I would like to go back at some point to BSB just because I enjoyed it that much.
Fuck yeah. It's amazing. And, like, the scenes you get there, Brands Hatch, like,
The people
is what I mean. Like, it's wild.
Yeah, and the race battles end of season.
Yeah, I know.
Kyle Ride and Tommy Bridewell, end of the year.
Crazy.
Fuck, that was insane racing. Literally banging bars till the end. Glenn Irwin trying to hold up Tommy Bridewell. Those two hate each other. Like, that's the vibe you get, what we were talking about. Like, when two people don't like each other and they're racing, and, like, hands down, Glenn Irwin was trying to hold up Tommy Bridewell. I will stand my ground on that till the day I die. I love both riders, Tommy and Kyle. I wanted Tommy to win the championship, but as much I wanted Kyle to win because the younger guy coming up, Tommy because he's on the Honda, and I've grown up with Tommy. But when I was seeing Glenn do that, I was going to smash the TV to pieces. I'm like, why are you doing that? And it's just because he didn't want Tommy to win.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not your battle to be involved in. It made it exciting, you know, mate. And then, you know, people were like, nah, it's not like that. And then when Glenn come to shake his hand and Tommy just went like that, I'm like, you know, that speaks enough for what happened. But now the racing's good there.
Pure racing.
Good battles, bro. Yeah. Like, I love watching BSB. That's why I go a couple of times and I go and sit on the bank with the spectators and fucking kick back and watch racing because it's so good to watch.
Pure racing. We got a lot of messages about BSB. It's just a shame it's on the other side of the world. Yeah, it's very cool. I want to talk to you about, like, it's Scott David Goggins Reading at the moment.
Let's go, baby.
And carry the boats. And I've been following all your Instagram and I've seen, you know, you running it. Like, it must be hard work because you're in England. It's like cold and rainy outside and you're going for a run. There's two things out of that. You feel invincible when you're doing it because everyone's inside, but you're like, why the fuck am I doing this? But it's inspiring to watch. Has there been a change in mindset in yourself?
Yeah, massively. Like, some things are personal. Some things have really lit the fire in me for this year. But I am out in California in the winter. So I don't want people to go, oh, but he lives in California. Yeah, I'm out in California. My wife's there. We had a newborn baby. So I've got, like, this comeback year and we have a newborn baby. And it's quite a lot to deal with because I'm not getting paid. You know, quite opposite. I'm actually paying to ride, which I said I'd never do, as I said earlier in the podcast. But I'm in that position. I had to do that route to have the bike that I know I can perform on. It's one of those years. It's a make or break year for me. And I know that. And I'm not afraid to say it because I know, like, I've literally put everything and more into it. I have an amazing team around me. I have an amazing bike. And I have the vision that I can do it.
Yeah.
And if I didn't believe I could do it, I would not have took this journey. I'd have gone and got paid and, you know, fizzled out my career, but I'm not that guy. That's what I told you before. So I lost almost 6 kilos from last year because everyone's like, oh, the weight, you know, and there's this weight limit, which is half bullshit anyway. And I'm just like, fuck, what can I do? And I'm like, you know what? I love my cycling. That keeps me mentally sane, cycling. I have my cycle team and I love that. It's my enjoyment. And I'm relatively good, so I race quite a lot,
but
my legs just got a bit big. So I was like, fuck, I'm just gonna have to run. So I was not eating, I was running, I was walking, and, like, I get hungry, I just go run again, and I was just running and running. You know, I'm on crunch time with the baby, trying to help the wife, trying to lock in on everything, and I had these words on the mirror I read to myself every morning, and I'm like, just fucking locked in for the winter. Yeah. And the weight was coming down. I got down to like 76 kilos from 83 of the end of the year. You know, I'm not at that now because it's hard with traveling to maintain and, you know, be strong. But it was just in my head, I have to do it. I said to the team when I left, I will come back, I will be 76 kilos. Oh yeah, you said that last year. I know I'm different now. There is a different Scott Redding that has been born since the Jerez test. When I wasn't allowed to test the Ducati bike, a fire got lit and it got personal.
Yeah.
And that motivated me. Like, thank you very much. Yeah. Like, you fucking ignited me to be the guy that I was when I was 16 and I was hungry. I'm that guy again now, but with experience and knowing what I can and can't do. And I just beasted it. I hated running. Like, if you follow me, I hate running. And I've said, you'll never see me running. And I think from November last year to now, I'm just shy of 500 kilometers running.
Yeah, wow.
And I just told myself, and I watch Goggins every day. I listen, I had this playlist of 5-6 motivational things, and I get locked in. And sometimes I had to stop myself running. Like, I'd go out for like a 10K. And I was like, nah, fuck that. I didn't eat today. I've done 10K. Yeah, fuck, what would Goggins do? Yeah. Keep running. I turn around, I run all the way back. And it just made me feel good. Like, I literally, you callous your mind to be different.
100%.
Like, it is true.
Yeah.
What he says is true. I so don't true. Care what people say. Oh, you train. Everyone says you train too much, you're going to burn out. That's a you problem, not a me problem. I worry about me, you worry about you. And I just locked in, like, seriously hard. Like, it was quite scary that I've never been in that place. Then I come here, I'm like, I am ready.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I'm in the best position, best place I've been to do what I want to do. And I'm not being paid. So, like, because everything's on the line, I'm going that extra all the time to be sure that if it doesn't work, I can sit back and go, you know what? I fucking give it 110%. Because everyone says, oh, I give 100%. Yeah, you do. Like, but you could do more. You know,
what's David Goggins say? It's normally you hit 40% and then 40% is normally that someone's max.
Yeah, and it's not. And, like, he doesn't count. Yeah, that's the thing. It's same when I'm running. Like, I was looking at the watch and I was, fuck the watch. Just run. Yeah. Just keep running. Don't worry about it. Like, we always want to show what we're doing and how good we are and how nice everything is. And that's all bullshit, because reality is life is not easy in general. You know, you have things that you think, fuck, that's hard. And it might be something small, but it's something you got to deal with. But everyone posts how nice it is. Oh, we're flying business class. Oh, we're doing this. Bro, I don't even have a rental car here because I can't fucking pay for it. I came here in absolute economy, couldn't bring my family because I don't have the money to pay for it right now. That's the truth. Mm. I've got no shame in that whatsoever, because I've invested for an opportunity to make myself great again. And I will give everything to do it.
Man, that's inspiring. That's very cool. And, like, it's so refreshing to hear as well. And it's amazing how much, as you said, callousing your own minds can just open up life. And, like, I'm no world superbike rider, obviously, but just going through that path of finding yourself through, like, exercise is such an experience, because you find out what you're really made of. And if it's waking up at 5 a.m. for the 10th day in a row and you think, why the fuck am I doing this? Yeah. But then you go out and you do it. You just realize how far you can actually push yourself. And I thought, like, man, like, back in 2020, I thought, like, God, I couldn't do anything. Like this is crazy that you can do that. And then you do it. And then you it's like another world opens up.
Yeah,
and then everything becomes easier.
It's only crazy until you do it.
Exactly.
And, like, when I listen to a lot of the motivational stuff, and I just think, fuck, it's so damn true. But people say it's not true because they're scared of it. They're scared to push themselves to the limit. Like, I always say this thing when people say you're overtraining. So, like, when I started cycling, you know, you do like 60 kilometers, it's a 2-hour ride. Like, that's a pretty decent day. Like, that's pretty good. And you go ride with some people, they do 100K, and you think, fuck me, like that's the next level, that's it. And you do that for a year, and then you start meeting people that race, and they do 160K ride a day, and you think, fuck, that's the level. Like, I thought 60K was a lot, now I'm doing 160K. Then you go ride with some pros, and they're doing 260K, and the level's up again. So it's what you compare yourself to. And that's what I was doing, is I was comparing myself to people in running, and I'm a bad runner. And it used to make me not want to run because I was bad and I didn't need to run. There was no reason for me to do it. I could go do somewhere else. But then I was, like, running one day thinking, why are you thinking about other people?
Yeah.
Focus on yourself. And that was when, like, the running changed for me. Like, I focused on me getting faster, putting in the work, doing the program, getting better. And then I go back to do my 5K PB and I smash it by 2 minutes. And I'm like, okay, now I'm half competitive. Like, I can run with people. But the fact was, I focused on me. So, like, I did some I want to call it motivational on Instagram, of telling people, you don't need to be the best to start. Like, you don't have to be good at something to start. Like, you can start from nothing. Like, I take an example of my sister. She wants to start running. She's trying to do too much. I'm like, just take it easy. Go do 500 meters day one. Day two, go do 550 and build on yourself. Slow down. It's not a race. Just your step. Just because someone runs past you doesn't mean you have to run faster. You need to do what is right for you.
Yeah.
Not what everyone else expects. You know, oh, what's your time? What pace? What this? That's great, but that don't fucking matter right now. You focus on you. And then she starts to build. And she starts building. People, like, the amount of people that message me saying, you've motivated me to run today. And that fuels me. Yeah. I'm like, that is great to hear, that instead of people feeling like put down because everyone's living this nice life and they're doing all these runs and cycles and living it all, like, somebody being real, saying, actually, it is hard. I find it hard, but I would do the journey with you. Like, and we'll start and we'll build. And people are saying, fuck me, like, you really motivated me to run. Like, you got me back into running. So nice to see that. I got my running shoes. And then I go to the paddock, a few mechanics. Hey, Scott, like, I started running again because of you. I'm like, fuck, good. Like, that's what I want to do. I think it's good to give back to people when it's here. It's not, I'm not physically doing anything. It's just making them watch the video going, I should probably start running again.
100%. And it's true. Like, it's, there's levels to it. And, you know, it's just, it's such just a mindset thing. And you just have to not worry about anyone else. And that's the problem with social media at the same time.
It's so hard.
It's so hard to, and we've all been caught doing it, like comparing. It's such a normal thing to normal. Do. But, like, yeah, as you said, it's just 500 meters and 550 meters. Yeah.
One step at a time. That's what I was saying. It's one step at a time. And I was doing half marathons in training, fasted, no breakfast, didn't eat from 6 p.m. the night before. Why? Because I didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
I was like, fuck it, it's 6K. I'll do 7. I'll do 8. I'm at 10. I'm fucking halfway there. Oh, it was hard. And my knees hurt. My ankles hurt. I was tired. I was pretty dehydrated. I had nothing on me, but in my head, that was the goal. And every step is one step closer to a kilometer. And every kilometer was one step closer to finishing.
Yeah.
And then next time I said, fuck, I did a half marathon.
It's funny. And then you feel awesome.
Oh, amazing.
You feel great.
Absolutely amazing. I think for mental health, training in general of any sort is so good.
Physical activity.
And, like, some people, like, they don't feel like they can be in the gym. Like, they're a bit nervous, you know. They don't want to go and run because they feel like they look stupid. Go run at 4 a.m.
Yeah.
Go run for 30 minutes, 4 a.m., go back to bed.
Yeah.
I tell you, you will feel fucking good.
You feel better than everyone else that's still asleep.
You've already ran 20, 10, 30 minutes before anyone's done anything else in the day. Go be that person. Then you've got nothing to be ashamed of. I get if people are overweight, they feel bad. Go fucking change it. Mm. If you want to change it, go change it. It won't happen in a day, a week, a month, but it will change if you stick to a plan.
Just got to be, it's just consistency.
Every time.
That's all it is. No matter if it's consistency and you're overweight, and it's just walking. Like, you walk every morning and then you slowly build up from there. That's all it is. It's just that base, and you just got to just, you just gotta kind of just fucking do it.
Won't happen. It will not happen overnight. And with my weight loss, what I did is hard because there's nothing to me. So, like, I literally needed my body to eat itself. So I was fucking hungry all the time. Like, for me, eating a lemon was a pleasure. I enjoyed eating lemons after my run. But that's what I had to do. Yeah. And I knew it wasn't going to be easy. And normally I give up after a couple of days, so I don't see results. But I just had something in me that said, just keep at it and it will change. Then I saw change. Then I got confidence. And then I was building and building. Then I come to my goal. Got to my goal. And I thought, fuck, I might go for 75. You know, that's the thing. You get there. And I generally thought 76 for me. I was not that weight in Moto 2. You know, I was 78 kilos in Moto 2. And that was many, many years ago. And I was now weighing less than in Moto 2.
It's amazing that.
Yeah.
It says, how's overall training in like what you've noticed from when you were younger to now? Like, has there been a development in programs on what specific weight you should be doing or like what training you should be doing? So, like, I assume back in like the 90s and the early 2000s, there wasn't much training going on. It was just eating pasta and whatever. But I think now, like, is there proper gym routines that you should be doing? Like core, is it like a lot of core strength?
Yeah, I'll be honest. Like, I don't do any of that.
Yeah.
Like, when I was younger, I was also training like a fucking beast because I felt unfit and I was always worried I wouldn't finish a race and I want to finish the race the strongest. Mm. So I was training like a beast and I was training like 5 hours a day, like 2 gym sessions, running, like just, I was overdoing it, but it was working. But now is like, I'm older. I feel like my muscle memory for it has changed. So I don't find it as hard doing races. I find it quite easy. And that's why I'm normally quite strong at the end of a race because I push myself deep waters in cycle racing and that mentally made me go a lot deeper. So now in the motorcycle racing, what I thought was the deepness was not, it was like halfway. But there's a lot of coaches out there now that are trying to do specific stuff to, but you just can't replicate it, which is hard to do. Like in my opinion, just having a good base fitness and having mobility and just general strength is good because if you put muscle on, you have more chance of building like arm pump because there's more muscle. Sure. So I always tell young guys, don't do that. You know, when we get ripped, look nice for the chicks. Like, yeah, I get it.
Get that summer bug going.
I was that guy in the past, but I said, forearms, leave that shit alone. Yeah, like, you want it to be small but strong. And different things work for different people. You can't beat riding a bike. That is the best fitness for a motorcycle racer to do because the muscles, you just won't replicate it. What I was doing when I was in Mark VDS MotoGP, I built like a frame of a motorcycle that was static and I would do onboard videos and I would do motos at night. I'd do like one whole race. So I'd add the leathers on and I'd be like leaning. Now they got all the hydraulic fucking fancy shit. I had some welded up frame with a Moto2 seat unit and tank and had a steering damper on it quite tight. I had like brake lever and clutch lever that had springs on it so I could try and replicate. Yeah. And I would do like an onboard of like Dovizioso at Qatar and like just every lap, just keep pressing. Like you probably had thousands of views from me. Like do a lap again. I do a whole like 20 lap moto. But then I went racing and fucking ached again. Like it's not the same. Mm. You don't have the same force and stuff. And like I say, the main thing is what suits you best. Like some guys run, some guys gym, some guys cycle. You know, smaller guys need to be stronger. They need to put weight so they can do gym. A taller guy like me, I stay away from the gym. I need to stay skinny. So it's very
true
thing for each rider. You just need to have a good base fitness and just ride and the best is to relax.
I love it. Mate, thanks so much for coming on. I could keep talking to you for another 3 hours, I reckon, about running especially. I love it. But it's awesome, man. Thank you again for giving us your time. Good luck for the weekends. We'll definitely see you down at the track. And good luck for the rest of the season, mate. We'll definitely be cheering on. And thank you for the support. It's been really cool.
No, like I said, I've been watching some of the podcasts. Yeah. Like the stuff you guys do, we said in the car. It's great stuff. So you guys watching, go look back to some of the episodes. they'll make you laugh. Good. Thanks for having me.
Nah, I really appreciate it, mate. Thank you.
Cool.
Cheers, mate. Thanks, guys.